Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Hello and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Hannah Floor. I'm a reporter here at Alaska Public Media, and I'm filling in for the regular Line One hosts. Today on the program, we're going to be talking about transportation safety, specifically pedestrian deaths. They've been increasing around the United States in the last 15 years, and numbers have been going up in Anchorage recently as well. Last year, a record-breaking 15 pedestrians were hit and killed by vehicles. This year, that number increased again. We're at 16, and the year isn't over. Decrease in road safety around the nation has been called a public health crisis. How is it affecting the way that people move around, whether they choose to walk or drive or bike, and how they think about those choices? And what can be done to reverse the trend and decrease the number of people who die in traffic deaths each year in Alaska? I have three guests with me today in the studio at Alaska Public Media to talk about pedestrian safety. Graham Downey. Graham is Deputy Chief of Staff to Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance. Hi, Graham.
Hello.
Also in the studio, Anna Bozin. Anna is the State Traffic and Safety Engineer for the Central Region of Alaska with the State Department of Transportation.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Lindsay Hyduke. Lindsay is with NeighborWorks Alaska. That's a nonprofit with a mission to strengthen communities. And she is also a transportation and pedestrian safety advocate.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you all so much for being here. So I want to start by talking about the reasons for these high pedestrian death numbers. Like I said at the top, they've been increasing in recent years around the nation, hit a 40-year high in 2022. Anna, I'd love to start off with you. How much do we know about what's driving the increase in pedestrian deaths, both here and nationwide?
Yeah, there's a combination of factors that are playing out nationwide and here in Alaska and even more locally in Anchorage. I first want to make sure that we understand that the transportation network is a system. It's a system of infrastructure that really shows up consistently across the United States as roads, as sidewalks, as bridges, as tunnels, as transit supported, supported infrastructure, and people. And it's a system that relies on people, and people make mistakes. And so right now what we're seeing is that system of all of the different design elements of it, how people are using that system, the choices that people are making. Many times they're coming to a head right now. Here in Alaska, we're seeing that speeding is a factor. Substance abuse is a factor. The vehicle fleet is a factor.
What do you mean by vehicle fleet?
The size of the vehicles on our roadways, and this again nationally, has increased tremendously since the system was first designed. And so I could go on and on, but we really want to make sure that the system is what we're talking about today, because there's multiple factors with every one of these fatal crashes.
So what I hear you saying is that there is no one cause, and it's kind of how all of those different moving pieces fit together that is really creating the problem that is coming to a head right now.
Correct.
Okay. Graham, looking at Anchorage, can you maybe talk about the top three factors in Anchorage? Can you pull apart the reasons that Anchorage has such high numbers?
Yeah, I think, again, to echo Anna's point, we're seeing the record numbers in the last couple of years, but we've had an unacceptable level of death on our roads for many years now. Some of the factors we've seen in the recent crashes, including like the time of day, which has to do with how light it is outside. So that leads us to believe that visibility is a factor. We also see more crashes during the shoulder season when there's less snow coverage, so there's less contrast between the pedestrian. It's harder to see. We see tinted windows being involved in a number of crashes, which also reduces visibility. And then we know that street lighting is sometimes inconsistent. Sometimes it's too bright and it causes glare. Sometimes it's not bright enough and it causes shadows. So lighting, time of year, tinted windows are all one of the factors. We also know intoxication is a factor in many of the accidents, both in terms of the pedestrians and the drivers. That's something we, you know, definitely want to be careful when we talk about. A drunk pedestrian doesn't put anyone but themselves in risk. A drunk driver puts all of us at risk. And so making sure we're addressing that behavior, giving people options other than driving for when they're drinking, and making sure that we're enforcing the law there is going to be a big factor. And then I think the most important factor, which is true everywhere all the time, is kinetic energy, right? How big is the vehicle? How fast is it moving? Someone is much more likely to die above 45 miles an hour than they are below 45 miles an hour. So when we have roads that are designed for those higher speeds, there's just going to be more energy involved in the collision, and someone is more likely to die, whether they're hit as a pedestrian or in another vehicle.
You said 45 miles an hour is kind of that magic number. How many of our roads around Anchorage have a speed limit of 45? And, you know, honestly, I think if you have a speed limit below 45, that means a lot of the drivers are going to be driving around 45 anyway. So where, what sort of proportion of roads in Anchorage have that higher speed, and where are they located? Can you give us some examples?
You know, I couldn't off the top of my head give you the percentage, but we do know that almost all of the deaths are happening on those 45 mile an hour roads. You know what I mean? Thinking roads like Tudor, Benson and Northern Lights, or faster roads like the highways. So we are definitely seeing that is where the deaths are happening.
Hmm. Why is, Anna, you had something to add?
Yeah, I would just like to also add that our volumes, our traffic volumes have been flat or declining. And many of these roads were built with the intention to have a lot more traffic volume. And we know that when there's higher traffic volume, people drive slower and more cautiously. And so what we're seeing now on these higher speed roads, that there's more capacity there, and therefore people are able to achieve higher speeds for longer periods of time. So that really does increase the risk to those navigating those same corridors now that operational speeds are generally higher than maybe in past years.
So what you're saying is when roads are emptier, people go faster.
Correct.
And because there are maybe the roads were designed for more cars than are actually filling them now, the cars are going faster now than
Correct.
They might have had they been filled with the cars that the designers expected them to.
Correct.
Okay. Lindsay, you're nodding.
I would also add that we've designed our roadways to be overbuilt for vehicles, but we have really under-designed for people walking or biking or rolling or needing to access the bus. So we have these really high-speed roads that are often the places you need to walk to in order to get to businesses or to get to one part of town to the other. And we have a really bad sidewalk network and gives pedestrians really bad decisions about how to keep themselves safe. So you kind of have to calculate the risks of waiting, you know, walking another half a mile to get to a lighted crosswalk with signals, or waiting for a big break in traffic because we know that we don't have as many vehicles on a road. So you just wait for the break in traffic so that you can cross mid-block, and gives pedestrians really bad choices.
Yeah, I think we've all had that experience of driving and having somebody sort of seeing somebody sort of dash across the road in front of us. This leads me to a word that I learned when I was doing research for this show, which is STRODES, combination of street and road. Lindsay, do you want to talk about STRODES and why they are a problem?
Sure. They get back to those high-speed roads where there are most of these collisions and fatalities, and not just for pedestrians and bicyclists, but for people in cars, more collisions and fatalities for everybody. A STRODE, it's trying to do too many things at once. It's trying to be kind of that through street where you could drive quickly to get from one place to the other. And it's also trying to be like that neighborhood street where you could get to businesses and pop in and out and have the kind of that local commerce. And it's all these conflicting kind of uses that don't get us a safe environment. There's a lot of the roads that we talk about trying to improve and make safer are these high injury network roads, Northern Lights, Benson, Tudor, Minnesota. It's these roads that are trying to do too many things when they're in oftentimes the heart of a neighborhood where people are walking or biking or catching the bus.
I heard you talking, all of you talking about the causes. It seems to me that these kind of fall into three buckets. We've got the problem of design. We've got the big wide open roads that encourage people to go faster, for instance, situations like low daylight, shoulder seasons, and then behavior, substance use, maybe distracted driving. How do all of those things fit together when we're looking at the data and figuring out what the cause for these high numbers are? Graham, do you want to take that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it's very hard to change the built environment overnight. I mean, that's something we've really been struggling with over the last year as we've been trying to respond to this crisis. So I think what that means is we need to be planning now for the way that we design the roads of our future. And we need to make sure that the roads we're building now and the roads we're planning to build in the near future are designed to make sure that everyone is safe on that road, that we're really prioritizing safety when we design our roads. So we need to make policy changes now to make that possible. And then I think the upside is things like enforcement and behavior are opportunities for us to make interventions now. We, you know, the APD has had a historically high level of vacancies over the last several years. We're addressing that now. We have full police academies. We're bringing community support officers online. So we're going to have more resources in the police department to be able to address the enforcement side, to try to curb some of these dangerous behaviors, whether it's distracted or drunk driving or aggressive driving.
Okay. Anna, you had something to add?
Yeah, I would also say that recognizing that we have some work to do on the education side of things. We're a state that doesn't require driver's ed or rules of the road education. And so that could be an opportunity to further, when we meet with community councils, we've met with 22 community councils and the FCC over the last year regarding our Vision Zero, and education is probably the number one thing that comes up during those meetings with the community. So if we could, like Graham said, it's going to take a long time to change the built environment, but if we can really get people aware of the situation and how physics works, then I think we could get a handle on some of those behavior aspects.
Okay, and we're going to talk about Vision Zero in the final third of this show when we talk about solutions. Lindsay, you look like you had something to add.
I was going to add some of the design. Of course, it takes a long time. We're talking about public funding for public health, transportation on public lands. So I also really stress that our roadways are public lands. We're deciding who gets to use them and how. And we can do some things sooner than later, including how we maintain and manage our roadways. We're a winter city and we have snow all the time. And something we do as a community is our policy is to plow snow from the roadways onto sidewalks, especially if they're adjacent to the roadway, or in bicycle lanes. These are things that make it even more dangerous and difficult to get around if you're not in a vehicle. So I know that the built environment may take some time, but there are practices that we can also address.
Are there places that are working on or have plans in place? Are there winter cities that Anchorage could learn from?
Yes. Our transportation community for the state and the municipality do lots of exchanges to learn from other winter cities all the time. We're not reinventing the wheel or learning new things.
Graham, you look like you had something to add there.
Yeah, the municipality recently joined the NACTO, the National Association of County Traffic. I've forgotten the full acronym, but a lovely group of traffic engineers who are really focused on urban design. Historically, our design standards have come from rural design, you know, sort of high-speed rural highways are how we built roads in Anchorage. So NACTO gives us an opportunity to learn from other cities. I think the upcoming conference is in Minneapolis, another winter city. So we do have unique maintenance challenges here. Our snow does not melt ever. But we do absolutely, I think Lindsay makes a really good point that in many cases, safety will be also aligned with fiscal responsibility. And so we can achieve both of those goals at the same time.
All right. And I want to really quickly, we have got a caller on the line, but I really quickly want to make sure we talk about the issue of slip lanes, which is basically when a driver is able to go from one road to another without going through the intersection. Classic example is right on red. That can be a problem because pedestrians are often caught in there. Can you talk a little bit about the way that having right on red, how that affects pedestrian safety. Anna, do you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. So when a driver approaches an intersection, whether it's signalized or otherwise, they are generally looking for a gap in vehicular traffic in order to make their turn at that intersection. You know, because we drive on the right side of the road, it's when they approach the intersection, they're looking to their left. However, our non-motorized infrastructure, so bikes, peds, transit, go both directions. And so it's really important for drivers to look right and left. A slip lane is a way to go faster through the intersection and really yield instead of coming to a full stop. And the design of it is such that those speeds then can be higher. And so you're reducing that reaction time and the ability to take in all of the context of that intersection. So it is vehicular-centric design. And in an urban environment, you know, that may be something that we could achieve in the near term to move away from that practice.
Eliminating the ability to turn right on red?
Eliminating slip lanes and then making sure sight distance at intersections is clear. And then, yes, if sight distance is a problem at a signalized intersection, restricting right turns, removing even right turn pockets so that the vision of the intersection isn't so wide. Again, when people are approaching that intersection, they may not be visible. So trying to narrow the intersection width overall. And that is a practice that's been going on nationwide, too, as we address this, is intersection safety is really critical.
Okay. Real quick, Graham, and then we're going to get to a color.
Great. Yeah, I might also expand that. I think slip lanes, you know, I think when I think of that, I think of Tudor and Lake Otis, where there's sort of those fully dedicated right turn lanes, creates a lot of additional crossing distance for pedestrians and uncertainty in the intersection. I think generally speaking, dedicated turn lanes in general are places where we have seen folks dying. You know, I think DOT is going to be taking a look at some of the couplet of A and C in Benson and Northern Lights, where we often have double left turn lanes or double right turn lanes. And that just creates a lot of uncertainty for everyone. I spoke recently with the freight industry, who's very concerned about safety, and those can cause a lot of problems for them because they have to watch out for a car turning inside of them or outside of them. And it just creates a lot of uncertainty for everyone when we have double turn lanes, dedicated turn lanes. So that's definitely something we want to look at as we're designing roads, and could be something that we could make short-term fixes on in terms of closing those when they're not necessary.
Interesting. Okay. Well, we are going to get to a caller. We've got a caller from Eagle River who wants to talk about the Muldoon area. Welcome to Line 1.
Thank you. Regards to NACDO, the main drag in downtown Muldoon there, especially near the Bar and Muldoon intersection. Muldoon is 40 miles an hour currently. It's been a long policy over the years for the Northeast Community Council to get that down to 35, like the main drag in downtown Eagle River. But currently, folks aren't convinced that just lowering the speed limit is going to do anything. I was wondering what, under the NACDO idea, it could be done to actually lower the actual speed limit the vehicles are driving through there, because Muldoon is full of pedestrians. If you go to Muldoon and look at everybody walking on the sidewalks, it makes downtown Anchorage look like a ghost town. And, you know, the record is terrible for people getting injured. So I was wondering if folks who know about NACDO could speak to what could be done to actually lower the speed limit to 35, because the state recently came out with the idea of doing that, and I'm not sure there's enough support to actually do it. They think lowering the speed limit alone won't do anything. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Anna, do you want to take this?
Sure, and I really appreciate people recognizing Muldoon Road. It's one of our top corridors of concern in our Vision Zero action plan. So Tudor and Muldoon are connected corridor and important corridors for many users. We are in the process of doing a speed limit study for both Tudor and Muldoon, and we've been focusing on getting public outreach and feedback on that and coordinating closely with the City of Anchorage. So that is a top priority for our agencies combined. And even a five mile an hour reduction, that would improve stopping distance. It would improve perception reaction times of being able to take in more information. When you drive faster, you're not able to really respond to, mentally to what all of the different conflicts that might be occurring in the area. And frankly, during peak times, you're not able to really travel 40 miles an hour anyway through there. There's enough traffic and traffic lights and things going on where you really are traveling lower than the posted speed limit at this time. So lowering that posted speed limit during off peak times could really improve safety tremendously, even like the caller said, 5 miles an hour.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we are about to go to a break, but before that, is there anything that any of you would like to add about causes of high pedestrian fatalities?
I would just add, you know, stepping back bigger picture, we are talking about pedestrian fatalities, and I think it's just really important to point out that everybody is a pedestrian. A pedestrian is such a strange word, but we're really talking about people. And it's how we get around our community. So when I think of pedestrians, I think of everybody. But I also especially think of youth who are walking to or from school or bus stops, seniors or folks who maybe don't have a vehicle or can drive. It really is everybody. And we throw out terms like pedestrians or vulnerable road users, but really it's just us with our flesh and blood trying to get around our community.
Yeah, and if I could jump in, statistic-wise, in Anchorage, in Alaska, Alaskans, only 30% of the population doesn't even have a driver's license. And so, you know, if we're talking about a system that should be, like Lindsay said, working for the public, we really have to design with that in mind as we go forward.
Wow, 30%.
And that's assuming that those people who do have a driver's license actually have access to a working vehicle, have the associated costs, you know, to maintain and purchase a very expensive vehicle, and et cetera, et cetera.
So. Yeah. All right. Well, you are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. We're going to take a short break, and then we will continue our discussion of pedestrian death rates with Anna Bozin, Graham Downey, and Lindsay Hajduk as Line One continues statewide.
I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in Unalaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Hannah Floor. I'm joined by Lindsay Hajduk, Graham Downey, and Anna Bozin. And in this segment, we're going to talk about the ways that high pedestrian death rates contribute, the factors that contribute to those how the factors that contribute to those deaths affect lives. So we have established that it can be risky for pedestrians in Anchorage and other places. Anna, how does the fact that it can be risky to walk or bike around Anchorage change people's behavior? Do we know?
We do have a transportation survey that is performed by local planning agencies. So we do get feedback on people's trip choices and generation, and that do inform some of our decision-making processes for funding and future design, et cetera. But I think I look at it from everybody's an individual, and they might have individual choices that they need to make at any given point, and that might change over time based on their situation. We know that car ownership is very expensive. Right now, it has skyrocketed since the COVID, so we're looking at an average of $50,000 to buy a new car, and the debt that is people are having to make choices on whether to pay car loans or to stay in housing. We also know that maintenance of it can be an ongoing burden. And then there's just the health, public health in general. I took the bus today to get here because it's important for me to understand how that system works. I have a daughter, and I make sure that she joins me in, you know, taking multimodal transportation around our city. It's about designing, knowing that it's about people-centered. And that land use part is important too. So depending on where people start their journey and end their journey, that same route may change depending on weather, cost, how they feel that day, the stress that they're under. There's so many factors in our human experience every day, and we just want to make sure that the system is supportive for all of those users.
You said that you took the bus. Lindsay, I know that you biked in to the show. What do you think about when you're thinking about biking? How do you make sure that you're staying safe? What are your considerations there?
Yeah, whether you're biking or walking or rolling, so scooters or have mobility devices, you have to go through a big mental checklist before you leave the house. And that in itself is a big barrier. You first need to know what your route is going to be, where there should be sidewalks or pathways, and maybe the conditions of them, especially after a snow or where we are right now. We haven't had snow in a while, but we have really big chunky ice on our pathways. So you have to know if you'll be able to navigate that. But that's just the environment. You also know that it's freezing outside and you're going to bundle up and put on all of your layers. And I know people think that if you're driving, you see people, oh, they're just wearing dark clothing. Any clothing is dark in the dark. So unless you have neon, reflective gear, lights, it's really challenging to be seen in our community. I feel like I'm a rave when I'm biking around. I've got a light vest. Mm-hmm. I've got flashing lights on my bike. That's not an easy thing to acquire. You know, I've gathered things over the years because I'm trying to be as safe as I can. But that doesn't mean I won't get hit or injured or even die because I am able to try to move around our community in this way. And I really stress that for a lot of people, it's not an option of, should I take the car today? The options are, how do I get around our community to get food, to get to school, to get to work? Walking, biking, taking the bus are really the bare minimum that we should all be able to do. And transportation safety is a public health issue, especially because it's so many factors of how we invest our funds into which neighborhoods and where they go. One example that I work with really closely is the Fairview neighborhood. That's a neighborhood where, you know, 1 in 5 homes don't have personal vehicles. So a lot of people do depend on walking, biking, or buses. But they have a highway that cuts right through the neighborhood with high speeds, a sidewalk that's immediately adjacent to those speeds, and that we store snow on throughout the winter. So those are really huge challenges. And then we also know we know a lot of statistics too. We know that the people who are killed, especially pedestrians, are much more likely to be Alaska Native or Indigenous or people of color. And that often has to do with, it's because these neighborhoods where folks are concentrated are not safe to walk and get around and have these highly dangerous roads.
Why are those neighborhoods where they are concentrated, why are they not safe? Is that specific to those neighborhoods? What's the correlation there?
Well, actually, in our context, in the Fairview neighborhood, the city did site the highway in what was traditionally a Black neighborhood, a thriving Black neighborhood, because it was a neighborhood of people of color. And we thought that, well, we know that transportation can be sited in places that further disadvantage those neighborhoods and break them off from economic opportunity. And that's borne out in our community in Fairview, but you can see it all across our country. And I would say you could see it in other neighborhoods in our community as well.
Mm, okay. We have been talking specifically about Anchorage, but I have a caller on the line here. This is Britta Hamry. She's with the Alaska Municipal League, and the Alaska Municipal League is working with communities around Alaska that received funding from Biden-era bipartisan infrastructure law that helps local and tribal governments prevent roadway deaths and injuries. So I want to hear from Britta about what information do we already have from those studies about what roadway safety looks like around the rest of the state. Welcome to Line 1, yeah. Britta.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us. So through our Safe Streets and Roads for All cohort, AML is supporting 21 communities throughout the state, as far south as Prince of Wales Island, to Seward Peninsula communities, and as far north as Kotzebue. Something recognizing that those communities, there is a huge variety in terms of the environmental conditions as well as the length and conditions of their transportation networks. I guess I just want to echo something that we're hearing from communities, as reflected earlier in this conversation, is the need for designated safe pathways or routes for non-motorized travelers, whether that's pedestrians or cyclists, how you are moving, how you're rolling. That's a need that we hear from communities throughout the state. And perhaps in a more rural focus, dust mitigation is a huge issue, and that is both for roadway visibility as well as a public health concern in terms of how that those inhalants impact individuals' health, both the vulnerable and non-vulnerable among us.
And Britta, is that because in many rural places in Alaska, the roads aren't paved, and so then there's lots of dust that comes up?
Okay, yes.
Thank you.
And that as we experience different patterns and weather, when is the best time to, either wet down surfaces without encouraging further erosion, or potentially the shift to asphalt or pavement might not be the best fit for a community, either budget-wise or with other considerations. And then looking at a lot of our rural communities, lighting and what lighting technology is currently in place and what lighting technology is going to increase safety for our Southeast communities or communities that are experiencing some now longer shoulder seasons. That reflection on wet surfaces can often become a hazard in and of itself. And so finding the right technologies for both the local network and also the majority user groups for that transportation network is another emerging theme that has come up. As well as, and this isn't unique to our rural communities, but interaction between non-motorized and motorized traffic. But for our rural transportation networks, that can often look like ATVs, side-by-sides, and snow machines sharing the road with both cars and pedestrians, and that there's different cultures of safety and different points of intervention and education that really are community-dependent on understanding what works best for each individual community and their individual transportation network. So those are some of the things that we're hearing preliminary that are shared kind of statewide throughout communities and their concerns. But ultimately, the Safe Streets and Roads for All program, which is a program of the Federal Highway Administration, the effort is that one too many, that any serious injury or fatality on a transportation network has significant impact for the community, even though if we're looking at the national crash data, the Alaska numbers aren't demonstrably too high, but we recognize for our communities that that is one too many and that the ability for post-crash care can be significantly limited in our off-road system rural communities. So any effort to reduce serious injury or fatality is certainly worthwhile.
Thank you for your call, Britta. I appreciate that. And yeah, that's a good point. We're talking about numbers, but we have to remember that each number is a person. Anna, you had something to add?
Yeah, no, that's great to focus on. I know that data is also sometimes lacking in rural locations. So just sometimes when there's a crash, we only hear about it, whether it's a serious or fatal crash. But much of the program relies on analyzing data from a statewide perspective. So just encourage other forms of data that you can submit for your grant or for project information is very helpful.
All right. We are getting close to the end of our second segment, but before the break, is there anything else that any of you would like to add about what's at stake? Graham?
Yeah, I think when I think about transportation, I think I often think about freedom. There's a certain kind of freedom that comes from being able to get in my car and drive to another part of the state on the road system or to the hillside or Kincaid to be able to recreate. I think there's a lot of freedom that comes from being able to own a car and being able to afford a car. But we also need to be designing our transportation system so that everyone has the freedom to move around and to be able to make the transportation choices that they want to be able to make and that they can afford to make. So for me, often being on a bike is a form of freedom. I don't have to fill up a gas tank, right? I can get myself from point A to point B. I can go wherever and whenever I want, especially as a young person. That was a real source of freedom for me. For our elders who might not be able to operate a vehicle anymore, you know, we need to have a robust bus system to make sure that they can move around. So a lot of this is about safety. And the way that we've designed our road system with how dangerous it is has a real impact on everyday Alaskans' freedom to move about and to achieve their goals. So, yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to freedom.
Yeah, thank you. Anna?
Yeah, and that's such a great point about the freedom to choose how you go. Sometimes we have a lot of tourism here, so we have a lot of people coming into our state that are not familiar with the area and may not be able to or choose not to rent a car. There's not enough cars for them to rent anyway. So, you know, it's an economic impact to our community if we can't accommodate those users as well. And we have to think about young drivers. Intersections are very complex. And so whatever we can do to design, to make those decisions and pinch points as simple as possible and intuitive as possible will help, you know, all the users.
And I'll also just stress that what is safer for pedestrians is safer for everybody who's using the roadway. And again, pedestrians are people. So if it's safe for people, we will all get through our community more safely. Last year, we did lose 15 pedestrians killed on our roadways, but we also lost 14 people that were in cars. So we reached about 30 people that were killed on our transportation system last year, and we're approaching that again this year. That's 30 families that lost somebody in a violent death. And that's also 30 people that were driving, that were part of those collisions. It creates huge impacts on our community. And we know the solutions. We know that we can implement them. We need the political will and the public pressure to make it happen.
You have given me a very easy segue. When we come back from our break, we are going to talk about possible solutions. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue our discussion of pedestrian deaths with Anna Bozen, Graham Downey, and Lindsay Hajduk as Line One continues statewide.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Hannah Floor, and I am joined by Lindsay Hajduk. She's with NeighborWorks Alaska and an advocate for pedestrian safety. Also here is Graham Downey with the Mayor's Office and Anna Boza with the Alaska Department of Transportation. In this segment, what can be done to decrease the number of pedestrian deaths? And what's the balance between changing the way a place is designed and enforcement of laws like speeding? Where does personal responsibility come in? So we've already talked about the problems. Seems like there is a wide range of solutions from redesigning roads, changing the way traffic signals work, increasing enforcement. Anna, I'm curious whether there is an agreed upon set of recommendations, a priority list of some kind in terms of what can be done.
So on the statewide level, we have something called the Strategic Highway Safety Plan, and that is a comprehensive high-level guidance for public road safety. And worked with our municipalities and boroughs across the state to look at the data as well as make findings and recommendations. And so the department is taking guidance from that document for design criteria and implementing new projects, as well as looking at how to partner with local agencies regarding some of the elements of it that are more controlled by them. So enforcement and education. And but again, if I could recenter us on that, this is a system. And it's a layered approach. It used to be that our agency and agencies nationwide had something called the three E's: engineering, education, enforcement was our strategy, national strategy for dealing with safety, and that assumed that each of those are siloed But we need to recognize again that the system is matched cohesively, and that we have different layers so that when people do make mistakes, that they're less severe, that they're recoverable, and that there's a design element of a safety factor included in that. So it's a roundabout way of saying that it's complex and that we are looking at it from a local perspective as well as statewide perspective.
And I hear you say when people do make mistakes. I think that's a really great point, that everyone using the transportation system is human and fallible and will make mistakes. And so it sounds like the design needs to be such that when people mess up, it will not be a fatal error.
Correct. Very, very good.
Graham, what has the LaFrance administration done in the last year, year and a half since it's been in office to change these pedestrian death rates?
Yeah, so I think one of the most exciting things that's happened, and really appreciative to Anna and our partners at DOT, is for the first time ever, we have a collaborative working group with the state to address road safety. And that's really critical because, not to place blame, but almost all of the deaths are happening on state facilities, on state roads. There are municipal roads that are in that high crash network, but predominantly we're talking about Muldoon, Tudor, the highway, Minnesota, Northern Lights, Benson. These are all state-owned and operated facilities. So having that collaboration with DOT over the last year has been really phenomenal.
Sorry to butt in.
Yes.
Why is it that most of those have been on state roads?
You know, I think one reason is that a state facility has slightly different priorities than a local facility, right? The goal of the state has often been to move traffic through and to sort of that point A to point B, prioritizing flow of traffic over necessarily sort of the local context. And so I think that's one of the reasons. The state also tends to build more rural roads. So the way they're set up is to build those kind of higher speed, wider facilities. That's what they're sort of structurally ready to maintain and build. It's also the case that, you know, historically the state has built a lot of roads in Anchorage and elsewhere in the state, right? So that's also one of the reasons why we're seeing that. But in Anchorage, there are things we can control and have taken steps to control. APD has used the high crash network to change how they're prioritizing enforcement in order to address those most dangerous roads and try to curb some of the aggressive behavior there. We've conducted some assessments. We've done speed limit reductions on Spinard Road. DOT has done speed limit reductions on Elmore Road, and we'll be looking at more roads. We'll be doing a comprehensive speed study soon for all the roads in Anchorage as part of a federal grant.
And I remember you telling me at some point that the reduction on Elmore Road, which is a state road, and Spinard as well, which is a muni road, were the first two speed reductions that have happened in Anchorage. Am I remembering that right?
You know, I don't have all the history, but my understanding is generally we've increased speed limits. So it is sort of a new historical thing for us to reduce a speed limit. And we've had to figure out how to do that. What is the engineering that it takes? As the caller from Eagle River pointed out, changing a speed limit alone doesn't necessarily change behavior. So we're also looking at all the other things we need to do to go with that change.
Okay, and we have a caller here. We're going to see if this is working. We've got a caller here from Anchorage. Bob is on the line. He wants to talk about how to change driver attitudes. Bob, you're on the line.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, good. That's half the battle in phone wars. 2 points, I guess. One is, you may have covered this early because I missed the first 10 minutes, but driver attitudes toward bicycles and pedestrians. Has that come up?
Yeah, I think, no, that hasn't come up yet on the show.
Now, I think there's many drivers out there, perhaps a higher proportion in Alaska and Anchorage, that don't believe that bicycles belong on roads, highways, et cetera. That's a predisposition toward a higher accident rate, fatality rate, because there's a very small minority that will actually actively drive aggressively to persuade bikes and pedestrians to get off the roads. You know, we paid for it with our gas tax dollars, whatever. If it's possible to parse the database for the police to find out that, I guess it's not, because my assumption is that when the police stop a driver in an accident involving bike or pedestrian. They do blood tests for drugs or alcohol. And if there's no violation discerned, they'll just kind of send them home. There's not much opportunity for real learning if that is the approach. And if the database doesn't reveal any more than that about the motivation of the driver, I think that's an area to look at. Because what I heard in the earlier part of the program is there's not much we can do about the built environment till the next round, till we design new roads. That, you know, I'm glad there's funding available. This is point two. I'm glad there's funding available for the programs that you're doing, and they sound well thought out. But I don't detect any passion at all. I detect professionalism, science, et cetera, but that can turn into complacency. And I'm still wearing my Jeff Duesenberry t-shirt from when he died on a bicycle years ago. And every time I put it on, I think fond thoughts about what a great guy he was, and also anger for the situation that killed him. And I think that it ought to be like a job requirement that people working in this program be able to demonstrate genuine anger at the high rate of death. So I'll leave it with that. And if you have any comments, I'd love to hear them.
Lindsay, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, thank you, Bob. That really resonates. Getting to the driver attitude, I think it's really hard to capture aggressive driving, including aggression towards pedestrians and bicyclists. I know I've had things thrown at me from vehicles, but there's not a database to report that at. Bad aim, they missed me, luckily, but that happens a lot in our community. And at the same time, we do experience a lot of people who just don't see you, don't notice, and try to make a change for it. But if our roads are designed for folks to go fast and not have that reaction time, it's dangerous for everybody. So I think there's a huge opportunity to improve driver behavior, including just taking a moment to think about or experience what others maybe go through when they walk or bike places, and invite people, if you mostly drive to get around, think about taking a trip where you're walking or biking, and take it and just experience what it's like to literally walk in someone else's shoes. And then when it comes to design, I know it takes a long time to redesign a road. I know it takes a long time to redesign, fund, and construct a road. There's a lot that we can do in the meantime. Pilot programs are a great opportunity to test things out. We did that recently with some protected bike lane projects. I would love to see this much more frequently for lots of things that we know work, including reducing lanes, lane diets, and we can do things quickly. You know, we manage snow and we tend to lose lanes in the winter anyway because of that snow. So what if we had policies where we are testing out lane reductions in the wintertime with what we have, snow? We also restripe roads all the time. And if we were restriping roads for narrower lanes, those help lend towards slower speeds, there's more space or less distance to cross if you're a pedestrian. We tested that out on Elmore. I want to see that more aggressively applied all across our community.
Do you mean that the lanes that cars, that vehicles are driving in are literally narrower, which means that there are more lanes can fit on the highway, but each one is a narrower?
You know, not necessarily more lanes mm-hmm. can be added. You can have a wider shoulder. You can have more space between a sidewalk and the driving lanes. But consider Tudor Road. You know, it's two lanes each way. Those lanes are so wide. You can see the ice and snow patches between the lanes. They're probably 4 feet wide in some spots. That's just extra road lanes that need plowing. That's extra time and money. It also means faster speeds because there's more width for people to feel like, oh, I can drive fast here.
People just feel comfortable because there's a lot of room and they just...
We need to design our roads for better behavior. We don't need to like cast blame on everybody. Our roads are designed for bad behavior, so we can improve how we design our community sooner than later.
So what's standing in the way of doing those making those changes? Yeah.
Well, I will say we are going to make those changes. We are currently piloting this winter protected bike lanes and trying to figure out how we can plow them. We don't have any protected bike lanes in Anchorage yet, so we're setting some up and having our plow drivers navigate them, trying out different designs, and figure out how we can have a year-round protected bike facility.
And I'm actually working on a story about that right now. And one of the things that I thought was fascinating about protected bike lanes is the fact that having that bike lane creates some sort of mental friction that really reduces those top high speeders and brings them closer down to the speed limit, which really makes the experience on that road with the protected bike lane much safer, right?
Yeah, that's right. And we also learned quite a lot from the Sixth Avenue bike lane pilot that happened last year. I think the two big takeaways from that are we can and should do quick build projects, and we will do that, I think, this next summer on Denali Road, which is a really critical north-south connection for Midtown, which is a place where a high percentage of the pedestrian deaths have been happening. So creating a safe north-south alternative on Denali, just using really quick like bollards or flex posts to sort of drop that lane, and then in the winter using it for snow storage, which will save us money and also improve safety, provide a barrier to the sidewalk. So we are going to be doing quick build projects next summer. It is hard for us to do that. Our whole transportation system is designed to take 7 or 8 years to really thoughtfully move through a community process to design and prioritize roads and then fund them and then design them and then build them. It's a really, you know, federal NEPA requirements, everything sort of stacks on top of it. And Lindsay knows Spinard Road has taken already 5 years and we're probably still 6 years away from rebuilding it. So we need to change how we build roads in order to be able to deliver these quick build projects. But the other lesson from the Sixth Avenue bike lane is that we need to have safer alternatives on our low volume roads. So this summer we built 14 miles of neighborhood greenways where we took roads that are really underused, dropped the speed limit to 20 miles an hour and painted sharrows on the road to create an alternative for walkers and bikers to the sort of bigger roads. And we didn't have to change or inconvenience anyone on the big road, we could create a safe alternative network.
Am I guessing right that sharrows is a shared arrow that indicates that drivers should share the streets?
Exactly.
Okay. Real quick, Anna, I'm going to get to you, and then we have a caller.
Sure. To talk more about what Bob was talking about, the driver behavior, I'm reading this great book called Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do by Tom Vanderbilt. And it's really about the psychology around it. And cars are built to be where the driver can be anonymous to the people around them. So you think about when you're stuck in traffic, you can get some road rage, some anger towards the car in front of you, and not thinking that there's a driver in front of you, that that's a person, and you have very little ability to communicate with them. When you're walking or taking the bus, you're not angry at the you're not yelling and swearing at the person in front of you. Same within the grocery store. So we really have to remind ourselves as drivers that we're part of the community, and to give people grace. I did have a driver come to me and my daughter and curse at us openly because he didn't want to stop at a stop sign and yield to us to cross the street in our neighborhood adjacent to an elementary school. My daughter was, she says all the time that that was the first time she has ever heard the F word used at her. So it's definitely a rampant problem.
Mm-hmm. All right, we are going to get to a caller. This is Polly in Anchorage, wants to talk about always on signals. Polly, you're on the air. Can you hear me, Polly?
Maybe improvements because, well, first of all, thanks for taking my call. And I'm a pedestrian, a cyclist, a walker, a skier, et cetera, and a driver. I have wondered if at every traffic light in town, if we could have 15 seconds of the white walk signal on automatically, because when I walk and want to cross the street, I want to wait for that signal, but sometimes I can't quite get to the post where it is, and the light changes, and I have to wait for a whole another cycle or jaywalk. So that's one thought.
And Polly, I'm so sorry, but I'm going to cut you off there because we only have about a minute for our guests to respond. So Graham, we're going to start with you.
Well, I think I could just say, yes, we are going to try to do that. So we're doing three different things at Signals. One is rest on red. So at night, having all of it be red so that people have the opportunity to slow down and cross. We're also doing something called leading pedestrian intervals, where pedestrians get a chance to cross before the light changes. And then we're also looking at having an all pedestrian phase, which is where pedestrians can cross at all sides of the intersection while the drivers need to wait. So we are trying all three things with some limited pilots now.
Does that imply with all pedestrian phase, does that imply that all cars are stopped at red lights and any pedestrian can walk?
In any direction too.
Interesting.
And that's been shown to be very successful safety-wise and efficient-wise for pedestrians. I would also add that there's some new technologies out there that we are evaluating for automatic pedestrian detection. That'll have to be researched for our winter city condition, but that way we wouldn't have to rely on a pedestrian to push a button. It would automatically detect when they're there, and that would be helpful for bicyclists as well, and that was trialed in the pilot study downtown successfully.
Okay, well, I am sad to say there is so much more that we could talk about. There's a whole pile of emails that I'm sorry to say I didn't get to, but we are out of time. So a big thanks to our guests. Thanks to Anna Bozin, Graham Downey, and Lindsay Hyduke for sharing their expertise. And thanks, as always, to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and producer, Madeline Rose. You can find this program and past episodes on our website at alaskapublic.org. We'd also love to hear from you. Share your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us, line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, your health connection. I'm Hannah Floor. Thanks for listening.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.